Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. It's an opportunity to respond to your questions. Your questions can be sent to us via radio program at AOL.com, and each week we endeavor to field as many questions as possible. Layla Budin is our Hoffman Center nutritionist, and she joins me each week for Q&A with Layla, and she has her own unique podcast that we've added to our repertoire at drhoffman.com, part of our Intelligent Medicine podcast series. So what have you been talking about lately?
Oh, gosh. I got through talking about possible causes of anxiety and depression and why it's so prevalent. Healthy fats, unhealthy fats.
By the way, American that healthy fats, unhealthy fats really hit it out of the park because you got a lot of Facebook hits on that when we put it up.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so a lot of people liked that and thanked you for your very careful elucidation of the problem because, you know, we get so much propaganda about polyunsaturated fats, how beneficial vegetable oils are for us, substitute saturated fat for vegetable oil. And I think you did a good job of explaining good fats versus bad fats. So,
and thanks for posting it. Yeah.
Oh, it's really a great addition because listeners can enjoy your own unique perspective on nutritional issues, bringing your vast experience to bear and your great training. So, before we get to questions, by the way, radio program at AOL.com is the way that you get questions to us, radioprogram@AOL.com. I want to share with you very interesting development. It's a new device that can help. It's like a Geiger counter for gluten.
How
if there's a radioactive site, you know, you take a Geiger counter and it starts to click, 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 you know, when it's when you're close to a radioactive source. This is a new device called NIMA, N-I-M-A, available for pre-order later this month. NIMA is a small portable sensor that consumers can use to quickly detect whether the food in front of them contains gluten. It's made by a small San Francisco technology firm called Six Sensor Labs, founded by Massachusetts Institute of Technology alums Shireen Yates and Scott Sundvor. The idea was inspired by their own experiences with food allergies and sensitivities. They say that existing tests on the market take up to 15 to 20 minutes to give an uneasy diner a definitive answer. Okay, that's not great because it's like, okay,
by that time, the food's cold.
The food arrives and you've got one of these devices and it's like, do you mind if I start eating, you know, while your machine gives me a reading on your food? It's, you know, yeah, go ahead and eat. You know, I'll let my food get cold. NIMA takes 2 minutes. So all you have to do is, check this out, all you have to do is place a sample of the food into a disposable one-time-use capsule and close it with a cap, and then you push the little capsule into the sensor, and you turn it on, and if the food does contain gluten, a little blue sad face will pop up on NIMA's display.
Oh, my goodness, like that's hysterical.
Like a frowny face. But if it's gluten-free, you'll see a happy emoticon.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, check this out. The sensor will detect.
People are going to start playing with their food now to see if they're.
I know. I got to get one of these things. You know, maybe this will
be. Yay, it's a happy face. I can eat this.
New sponsor.
Wow.
That's cool. Sensor will detect if the food contains at least 20 parts per million of the gluten protein. Now, that's pretty
low because
that's in adherence with the FDA's requirement that gluten-free food contain less than 20 parts per million. In other words, I mean, look, we can't guarantee you that a molecule of gluten has fallen on your food. That's probably not going to cause you to have a major intestinal or allergic problem. But it's very cool. It's very cool.
It is very cool. Wow. Yeah. I want to see it. Okay.
And here's the price point. $179. Christmas is coming. All right.
That's not bad.
That's not
bad for somebody who could really use something like that.
I'm
thinking of a caveat right now, though.
Yeah.
You're supposed to take a little sample of food and put it in a capsule.
Right.
Well, you kind of have to pick, it's kind of like doing that intestinal biopsy for celiac disease.
Yes, you're right.
You don't just take one bite. You got to take four or six.
Well, that's a fly in the ointment, so to speak, because let's say you got a piece of meat with some gravy, that may be suspect,
right.
And then you've got some
the gravy. Yes.
Then you got a vegetable on the side that may have a sauce. And then you got a soup that may have some flour in it, so you're gonna you're gonna have to do four or five different.
You got to bring a lot of capsules. So 2 minutes times five or six. Okay, so we're talking 10 to 12 minutes. That's still better than 20.
And you just gotta say, hey, listen, if you're gonna be going out with me or if you're dating me, you just gotta you gotta roll with this because this is what I have to do to stay well. Okay.
Well. The good news is that it's not actually a thing that's going to set off and buzz or vibrate every time you walk by a bakery or a pizzeria. You actually have to put something into it and so forth. So,
exactly. But there is a point that you make about the expense because they sell 12 packs of disposable capsules, but the capsules themselves, 12 capsules is $47.95. So if you have four different things to sample at a meal, say your meal is like $30, then you add about, 10-15 bucks to the price of the meal for the capsules that are designed to tell you whether your meal is okay to eat.
Well,
all right.
Well,
hey.
Maybe as it gets more popular, the price of that will go down.
Yeah. I mean, look what happened with desktop computers, right? My first desktop computer was $6,500. And I got it at a discount because I had a patient who worked for IBM. He got me one of the first laptops. $6,500, and it probably had the computing power of a, one of those Tandy computers,
Yeah.
64 kilobits or something like that. Who knows? Anyway, let's get on to questions.
Okay, we've actually got two questions from Marianne. The first one is, what is the proper dose of EGCG for weight loss support? Well, I think generally we like 1,000 milligrams twice daily with food.
Okay, and what is the plausibility of and the science behind EGCG as a weight loss supplement? Because, I think you share this view, is there's no magic bullet. There's no magic beans that make the pounds melt away. We hear so many ads on radio and on TV, and you get spam in your inbox about these miracle weight loss pills. But what's the true science behind EGCG? Because I actually think it's one of the things that is plausible, but only to a small degree as an adjunct to diet and exercise. So what's the deal?
Well, EGCG has been shown in the literature to provide some metabolic enhancement for weight loss, revving up the metabolism for weight loss. So
it's a little thermogenic, helpful. A little bit of a fat burner.
A little thermogenic, exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's where it can be useful. And the typical dose is, either 500 milligrams twice daily or 1,000 milligrams is probably optimal.
Okay.
And also, it's a very important antioxidant anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just highly recommended for anyone all around. But for weight loss support, absolutely. EGCG, we like EGCG.
Cancer prevention.
We like CAPC-8.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Brain protective and so on. Let's talk about CAPC-8 too, because CAPC-8 is also a thermogenic supplement. So what's going on with that?
From red chili pepper. So that's also very thermogenic, and the way to take CAPC-8 or CAPC-8 Gold, which is what it's called lately, you take about three of the capsules in the morning before eating anything at all, and it'll provide some metabolic burn. That's helpful. So that's capsaicin you take away from food, EGCG you want to take with food. And
right.
There are other supplements that can also help. Oh, carnitine is helpful for fat-burning metabolism. Not necessarily providing a metabolic enhancement the way EGCG and capsaicin do, but carnitine is also helpful.
For some people with energy metabolism
yeah.
problems. More for I would say carnitine more for people with low energy. I'm not sure that it makes the pounds melt off, but
yeah.
it does help fat get burned mm-hmm. by the cell, so to speak. If without
right.
carnitine, fat can't enter the mitochondrion of the cell to be mm-hmm. used as fuel. So that it's a transporter. Coming back to the capsaicin actually, some people might say, well, great, you know, I'm going to eat red hot chili peppers and then I'm going to break out into a sweat and, you know, my face is going to get all red and I'm going to start coughing and sputtering, my eyes will water. But actually, capsaicin is sort of a defanged red hot chili pepper. It is not, mm-hmm. It's a capsaicinoid. So that means it's like capsicum, which is red hot chili pepper, but it is molecularly reconfigured to have the thermogenic effects without creating the symptoms. And this is based on patented Japanese technology by a big company called Ajinomoto that is a real major maker of nutraceuticals. And I think there's some plausibility to it. There are a lot of studies on that. I mean, I like stuff that has been studied. So EGCG has been studied. Capsaicin has been studied. There's some good animal studies on it. There are a few small human studies looking at capsaicin for weight loss. There's also some studies suggesting that it can increase brown fat. Brown fat is
very important
as a fat burning fat as opposed to a fat storing fat. You know, the white fat is the kind of fat we get around the midsection. Brown fat is something that actually is a desirable type of fat that helps to burn fat. So it helps to restore brown fat in human studies. So anyway,
and I think it's the brown fat in newborn babies that helps to keep them warm.
Right. The basis of that is that babies don't have the ability to shiver. They instead use brown fat to generate heat. Adult animals and humans shiver, and by shivering there's heat production. And certain mammals have higher amounts of brown fat. Rodents have a lot of brown fat for some reason.
Yeah.
It was thought that human adults had no brown fat, but recently it was found that human adults do have small depots of brown fat. And one of the ways to develop your depots of brown fat is to get in the cold. So this is one of the reasons I like to plunge into the icy waters of Long Island ocean, in the month of May, when the temperature is about 62 mm-hmm. degrees in the water, and I'm figuring I'm revving up my brown fat.
Right. Another way that comes to mind to rev up brown fat, bring the thermostat down to 60 degrees and walk around in a t-shirt and shorts.
Yeah,
don't
absolutely.
Put anything else on. That could be hard to do.
Don't shun the cold.
Don't shun the cold, but don't sit there and
but
watch
do
the
draw
news.
The curtains.
You'll start
draw the
to get chilly.
Draw the curtains. Draw the curtains, though.
Draw the curtains.
Pull down the shades. If you're going to do that.
Yeah.
I don't know
what
neighborhood you live in. But.
So there's actually an advantage to being a little chilly.
Yeah. Okay. Or taking a little chilly. It's a pat play on words because capsaicin is derived from capsicum, but it's modified to be. To not cause you to sweat. And, some patients report that their appetite is blunted by that and that gives you the extra 5-8% that you need to shed a couple of pounds.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Marianne has another question. Dear Dr. Hoff and Layla, your recent podcast mentioned to many that blueberries may be a kidney stone risk, but I've been taking some blueberry extract. Is this a problem? Will it cause kidney stones? Blueberries in and of themselves aren't going to cause kidney stones, but for somebody at risk already has kidney stones, a lot of blueberries can carry a lot of oxalate. So the answer would be to have less of it. But the blueberry extract, because it's fairly potent, maybe for somebody who already has kidney stones, what would you say, Dr. Hoffman, to take less of it, maybe avoid it altogether?
I'm not sure that the blueberry extract creates more of a problem than eating a full serving of blueberries, because the extract may not necessarily concentrate the oxalic acid or the oxalate. Mm-hmm. So the extracts are often highly concentrated parts of the pigmented part, which may not contain as much oxalate. So I would say, you know, if you're going to take some of the extracts, you might take a pill or like a quarter teaspoon of a concentrated jelly-like substance. And, you know, that's a way to get the proanthocyanidins that are so valuable for brain and for blood vessels.
Yeah.
And may, you know, protect the telomeres from aging. So mm-hmm. I would say that's not a big problem, certainly not the extract. I mean, look, if you go whole hog on lots and lots of blueberries and you have lots of spinach, rhubarb, you know, what I worry about sometimes...
Black tea, right. Also.
You know, I worry a little bit about the kale craze. You know, I noticed that we recently had National Kale Day, which mm-hmm. was October 7th, happened to coincide with my birthday. So that's kind of like my birthday was commemorated by National Kale Day, which I'm, you know, uh-huh. I think kale is a good thing, but I'm not like someone who believes in, and I don't think you do either, believes in slugging down massive amounts of kale.
No, I mean, kale has become the new garlic or something like that. Overdoing kale can be problematic, I think, for those with hypothyroidism.
Right. It can be a goitrogen at high doses. I wouldn't worry about modest consumption of kale. They make nice baby kale salad ingredients. And I think that may be healthier than iceberg lettuce or some conventional agriculture product.
Yeah. But the problem happens is when somebody will take a big bag of kale
right.
and make a green drink every
yes.
morning.
Yes.
My question to that client is always, now, would you have eaten that much kale? Oh, no. I probably have that over 5 or 6 mm-hmm. salads. Well, you shouldn't put that much kale into a smoothie either.
I think some people think the worse it tastes, the more they think it's healthy. You know, it's kind of like the new cod liver oil or something.
No pain, no gain.
Right, exactly. But you can actually, there you can actually get a high doses, I think, of oxalate from
yes.
Green drinks, spinach smoothies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it and if you want to check it out, there are handy-dandy tables. We won't go through all the oxalate contents of various foods.
I'm going to actually podcast about that soon.
Good.
You know?
All right.
Green smoothie, friend or foe, and let's talk about why.
Okay, yeah. That deserves
and
a podcast.
To do it the right way.
That's going to rock.
Yeah.
Great. All right.
Yeah. So stay tuned, everyone.
All right. Awesome.
Okay. Our next question is from Joy. Joy had been taking strontium for a couple of years, had a bone density scan. Everything looks normal and even improved from previous scans. The only, quote, downside, she says, is my GP, when I told him about the strontium supplementation, he was skeptical. And while he did recognize it could lead to improved density, bone mineral density, he was concerned about increased brittleness as mm-hmm. a result.
Yep.
Do you have any thoughts about this?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, that is, you know, that's a legitimate concern. But I think that the GP is speaking from too little knowledge and too little investigation. If they want to make a pronouncement about strontium, they should look at the actual research on strontium. And I think that there's an inherent bias against something that you get in a health food store that seems to really work. I mean, how could it be so good if it's not approved by the FDA, if it's not sold as a drug, and if you can simply walk up to a counter in a health food store and take something that if you take it for 2 years, you'll see a dramatic improvement in your bone density. It can't be good, right? Because if it was good, it would be a drug, right? I mean, that's the logic most doctors follow. So it is a legitimate concern that strontium merely makes your bone look stronger. That is, I'm going to acknowledge that's a legitimate concern, but let me explain. Strontium as an atom, it's actually like calcium. Strontium is an element. And if you look at the periodic table of elements, you'll see in a row magnesium, in a column, that's a vertical column, magnesium, calcium, and then strontium. So strontium is actually denser than calcium. So when you take in strontium, and it goes to your bones, it actually lights up brighter than calcium. So some of what you're seeing on a bone density is actually the illumination of a denser molecule than calcium. So there is the argument that when you look at a bone density that says improved dramatically, like 12%, it may not be improved 12%. You have to apply a corrective factor, and perhaps it's only improved 6%. They generally the improvement, because strontium may create an artificial appearance of improvement. But what we have to look at are the actual studies. And most of these studies are done in Europe, where strontium is a drug. And in the studies done in Europe, and the studies have been done over long periods of time, in some cases, 10, 15 years.
And it's strontium ranelate, is it?
Right. They use strontium ranelate. But I don't think that the ranelate part matters. I think it's the strontium that's the business end of it. Ranelate is just a delivery system. And here we use strontium citrate. So the studies actually show that not only is there an increased appearance of bone strength, but there's actually a substantial reduction in both vertebral and hip fractures. So that's what we want. Now, I'll give you an example of something that that actually makes bone look stronger. And for a while, it was thought that this would be a great thing for osteoporosis. It's fluoride. You know, the fluoride that they fluoridate water with and they fluoridate toothpaste with. Well, it makes the teeth stronger. It actually does. And if you take it orally, it will go to the bones, and it will make the bones look more dense and light up, you know, to a greater extent, and then it looks great. But that is an example of something that does not enhance bone resilience. Yeah. It merely makes the bones brittle. And so the whole idea of using fluoride for osteoporosis has been discarded. And in addition, fluoride is toxic. I mean, it's at high doses, it's toxic. It's neurotoxic. It's toxic to the liver. And that's one of the reasons why there's
toxic
a whole...
to the thyroid to some degree, too.
Absolutely.
Because it competes with iodine.
So fluoride is controversial, and, you know, there's a lot of, you know, as long as I can remember, they've been anti-fluoridationists. You know, when I grew up in Southern California, it used to be, you know, people walking around with picket signs, anti-fluoridation. And now it turns out that there may have been something to it, is that, you know, we add this chemical on spec to our water supply to strengthen our teeth, but we may be doing damage to our bodies, and we're certainly not helping our bones.
Yeah.
So, I get what this doctor is trying to say, but if you look at the research, strontium doesn't just make the bones look stronger. They are stronger, and it does reduce fractures. And, you know, it's a prescription drug over in Europe. So may be just a matter of medical economics. It hasn't made its way over here and gone through FDA approval.
I know with our own case studies, Dr. Hoffman, we've seen a reversal in bone mineral density, going from osteoporosis, reverting back to osteopenia, and I know every one of those cases included strontium.
Oh, yeah.
Among other things.
It's absolutely
among
central.
Among other nutrients.
It's absolutely central.
And even DHEA, but strontium was present in all of those case studies. That we know.
And we've had a few cases where people have done our bone mineral protocol, and the results have been disappointing. And I said, well, did you take the strontium? And they said, well, you know, I kind of forgot about the strontium, or I was a little bit sporadic about taking this strontium. And I said, well, that's why you didn't get the results that we'd like to see.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Joy, thank you for your question, and congratulations on your improved DEXA scan.
So in effect, it's a testimonial, but you're just concerned that, you know, it's too good to be true. Is it real?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a good point at which to pause, because as you listeners know, we divide these podcasts into two parts. So we will return... for those of you joining us for part two. And in part two, give us a preview of a question that we're going to take up.
Every time I eat, I fall asleep. It doesn't matter what it is.
Wow. All right. We will take that up in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.